Okay, we're going to get started and start, of course, with saying good morning and welcome to our program this morning. My name is Doris Meissner. I'm a senior fellow here at the Migration Policy Institute, where I direct our work on U.S. immigration policy programs, and where we are very pleased this morning to be releasing a new report, which we're calling Deportation and Discretion, Reviewing the Record and Options for Change. Now, this event this morning is both in person for those in the room and also live streamed, so we welcome both sets of audiences. The report that we're going to be talking about is coming at an important moment in that there is again the possibility of an executive action on immigration sometime toward the end of this year. That executive action may well take into account some changes in the guidelines that presently are being used where removals and deportations from the United States are concerned. This work that we'll be talking about offers the most detailed look yet at the record of removals and deportations from the Department of Homeland Security since its inception. So what we're going to be looking at today is data from FY 2003 through FY 2013. The work builds on a large body of work that the Migration Policy Institute has developed over the years that have to do with various aspects of the enforcement system. This particular work today deepens a report that we released in the spring called The Deportation Dilemma. It digs more fully because we had more data into the information and into the findings that we developed at that time. You have bios on your chair of the speakers, and you also have a copy of the report, so I won't give detailed introductions for the speakers and their backgrounds, other than to say that our lead speaker is Mark Rosenblum, who is also the lead author on the report. He is the deputy director here at MPI of our U.S. Immigration Policy Program. His overall presentation of the report will be followed by comments from Rebecca Gambler, who is the director of the Homeland Security and Justice Team at GAO, the U.S. Government Accountability Office. And our second comment will come from Mark Neferi, who is an enforcement fellow at the American Immigration Council and also works extensively on related issues and issues of the criminal justice system and immigration connections. So with that, I'm going to turn the mic over to Mark. We will do the presentation and the comments and then have time for Q&A from the audience. Thank you.
Thanks, thanks, Doris, and thanks to you and to the team at MPI for helping pull this report together. It was definitely a group effort, and I want to especially acknowledge my co-author, Kristen McCabe, who was a co-author and a huge contributor to this report and is unable to be here today. So as Doris mentioned, this report analyzes every formal removal implemented by DHS between 2003 and 2013. And basically what the report does is it gives a profile of who has been deported from the U.S., a description of the removal patterns, how people are being removed, where and how they're being removed. And then we spend some time talking about how the actual enforcement practices line up with DHS's announced enforcement priorities described in the Morton memos in 2010 and 2011. And then we explore how potential changes to DHS's enforcement priorities could affect future removals. Let me just briefly say something about how we did this. The main thing that we did is to analyze ICE's administrative records from ICE's Enforcement Integrated Database, which is their main removal database. The data were obtained by the New York Times through a FOIA request, and we're grateful to the Times for sharing the data with us. ICE's database includes both removals and a certain number of informal returns. Our report and my presentation today focus exclusively on formal removals. We're taking the returns out of the conversation. We also use DHS data to model the non-ICE removals that don't appear in the ICE data set, but that are in the DHS data set because they were also removed. And that's basically CBP removals to Mexico and Canada, non-judicial removals to Mexico and Canada. And then throughout the report and my presentation, the data measure removal events, not unique individuals. So what that means is some people are deported more than once, and they appear more than one time in the data set. So it's a certain bias in the data towards these sort of repeat customers. Altogether, 3.7 million people have been removed between 2003 and 2013. So that's the universe that we're looking at over that 11-year period. Just sort of a basic profile of who's been deported during that period, formally removed during that period. 91% of removals have been men versus about half of all unauthorized immigrants who are men. 91% of removals have been to Mexico and the three Northern Triangle countries, Mexico, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, versus about three quarters of unauthorized immigrants to those countries. So the system leans in those directions. Some more sort of general information about who's been removed. This looks at previous criminal convictions. So this is lifetime. Have people ever been convicted of a crime? Simply being, unauthorized immigration by itself is not a criminal offense. And most people, 59% of all removals since 2003 are of people who have never been convicted of a crime. This tendency was especially pronounced during the Bush administration, when removals of non-criminals grew faster than removals of criminals. So the share of non-criminals among the removal population peaked at 67% in 2008. Removals of non-criminals fell between 2009 and 2011 during the first years of the Obama administration. So that drove the share of non-criminals in the removal population down to about 50%. You can see where the lines converge there. And then more recently, removals of non-criminals have once again grown faster, and we've actually seen removals of criminals tick down in 2013. So in 2013, about 55% of all removals were of non-criminals. The data and the report allow us to get into much more detail about the types of crimes that people have been convicted of, people who have been removed have been convicted of. So what you can see on the left side of the slide, the left pie graph is describing for the entire period that we're looking at, and then the right side is just looking at zooming in on 2013. So as I mentioned, 59% have never been convicted of a crime. And then looking at the specific types of crimes, about 13% of people removed have been convicted of a violent crime. About 9% have been convicted of a drug crime. About 8% have been convicted only of an immigration-related crime. And then the remainder are other nonviolent crimes and drug crimes, except I think I'm pointing at...
Yeah, and drug crimes.
Focusing in on 2013, you can see that the share of non-criminal removals has gone down a little bit. The share of people convicted exclusively of immigration crimes has gone up. The other wedges are all within about 1% of their decade-long average. So one of the sort of key findings of this report is that looking at the aggregate data that I just described hides some really interesting differences between people apprehended at the border and people apprehended within the United States. So this picture is border removals. And what you can see here is that the great majority of border removals are of non-criminals. It's the blue band. Or of people whose only criminal conviction is for an immigration-related crime, the red band. Those two categories together, so people who have never been convicted of any non-immigration crime, have consistently accounted for between 82 and 90% of border removals throughout this whole period, and about 87% of border removals in 2013. Among people who have been convicted of any type of violent crime at the border, that represents about 4% of border removals in 2013. So 4% violent crimes, 87% no criminal offense or just an immigration offense. The picture is completely different for interior removals. So just to emphasize this point, Those pictures look very different. For interior removals, for the entire period, about a third of everybody who's been deported from within the United States were non-criminals, and that number fell to 13% in 2013. Immigration crimes for the entire period represented 6% of interior removals, and that climbed to 13% in 2013. So that means that three-quarters of people removed from the interior in 2013 had been convicted of a non-immigration crime. And this slide goes into more detail about what types of crimes people removed from the interior and from the border have been convicted of. So looking at the left side of the picture, you know, as I said, about three-quarters of people removed from the border have never been convicted of a crime. Whatever it was, 12% have been convicted of an immigration-related offense. And then every other type of crime, about 1 or 2%. Among interior removals, about a quarter have been either never convicted of a crime or convicted only of an immigration-related crime. That's the first two wedges. 28% have been convicted of violent crimes. 15% are in a category of general nonviolent crimes. 18% are drug crimes. And 13% are traffic offenses. And of the traffic offenses, about two-thirds of those are DUI, and about one-third are other types of traffic offenses. So again, very different pictures at the border and in the interior. One reason it's important to understand the differences between border enforcement and interior enforcement is that the data also show different trends over time about where enforcement is taking place. So what this picture shows, the bars in this picture are the total number of removals. The black line is the number of border removals, people apprehended at the border and then removed. And the red line is people apprehended in the interior. So, you know, a first thing that you can see from this picture, which bears emphasis, is that the total number of removals has been at record levels during the Obama administration. The lowest year of removals during the Obama administration is higher than the highest year for any other president. And the last 2 years have each set all-time records for the number of removals. So there's some confusion in the popular discussion about removals, but there's no ambiguity that removals are at an all-time high. But looking a little deeper into this picture, what's interesting about this picture is that we see four distinct periods between 2003 and 2013. So in the first couple of years, the first 3 years of the Bush administration, removals were basically flat, and the ratio between border removals and interior removals was pretty much unchanged. So there was sort of a status quo, you know, no dramatic changes to the enforcement system early in the Bush administration. And then what we see beginning in 2006 is a steep increase between 2006 and 2009 in the total number of removals. And what happened then is that with the failure of the comprehensive immigration reform legislation in the Senate in 2006, the Bush administration initiated a real enforcement surge. And what you can see is that that was driven overwhelmingly by increased interior enforcement. These were the worksite raids and the other operations of the Fugitive Operations Team. This shows up in the data here as increased interior enforcement. Those numbers flattened out during the first years of the Obama administration. We see that the total number of removals was sort of flat and that there's no real change in the ratio of border to interior enforcement. And then most recently, since 2011, we've seen removals have started to increase again and that it's driven entirely by increased border enforcement, while interior enforcement has actually fallen during this period of rising removals. So very different things going on. One other way that border and interior removals differ is by the enforcement pipeline or by how enforcement is implemented. And what we can see here is that at the border, the majority of removals are expedited removals. Another 31% are reinstatements of removal. So altogether, 84% of border enforcement is non-judicial, either reinstatements or expedited, versus 16% judicial removals. In the interior, we see over half of all removals are judicial removals. And it's we see that many fewer expedited removals, as we would expect, because that's a tool designed for new entries. But it's noteworthy that 29% of interior removals are still reinstatements, and another 7% are administrative removals, which is another form of non-judicial removal for certain criminal offenders. So one last sort of removal pattern set of information I'll share is looking at the time between when people enter and when they're apprehended. As we'd expect, among border apprehensions, people are apprehended much more quickly. So 90% of border apprehensions occur within 2 weeks of entry versus just 6% that occur a year or more after somebody enters the country. And, of course, the pattern is different for interior apprehensions. Interior apprehensions, just 11% occur within 2 weeks of entry versus two-thirds that occur more than a year after entry. So it's a way of seeing that these populations look different from each other in terms of their fixedness in the U.S. It's also interesting to look at this reinstatement because this is, you know, this is a somewhat controversial procedure. What reinstatement means is that somebody who's been previously formally removed, if they get reapprehended, then that previous removal order gets reinstated without having an opportunity to appear before a judge and maybe argue that your circumstances have changed. What we see is that 72% of reinstatements occur within 2 weeks of the reentry versus just 15% that occur more than a year after reentry. The other key set of findings, or another key set of findings from this report, and you know, key sort of set of analysis, is that we compare actual removals to DHS's enforcement priorities, and you know, the bottom line finding is that most removals are consistent with DHS's enforcement priorities. This slide disaggregates removals into those that fall outside of DHS's current priorities. The bottom stripe, the purple stripe. Recent entrants, immigration obstructionists, and I'll explain exactly what I mean by that term in a moment, and then people who have been convicted of crimes. And let me make three points about the overall findings here. One is that 95% of all DHS removals since 2003, or between 2003 and 2013, fall within one or more of these categories. So 95% of everyone removed meets one or more of DHS's priorities. And the second point, that includes 93% of everyone removed by the Bush administration. So the Bush administration adhered to Obama's enforcement priorities. So when you look at these data, it's a little bit surprising that the Morton memos should have been a major source of controversy because, you know, it's clear both historically and in the data that they formalized longstanding priorities that already existed, you know, going back to the INS era. Having said that, a third observation about this slide is that we do see some of the trends that I talked about before also translate into adherence to these priorities. So although the Morton memos didn't break radical new ground, they did sort of redirect enforcement. And what you saw is that during the Bush administration's enforcement surge between 2006 and 2008, and we look at this in more detail in the report, the share of non-priority cases increased. And actually 2008 was the year that non-priority cases peaked at 10% of all removals. That trend reversed as soon as Obama came into office and the non-priorities fell to less than 1% in 2013. So, and you see that especially after the memos came out in 2010 and 2011. So the Morton memos have been effectively implemented, but they've also been criticized by some advocates for immigrant rights because they define DHS's priorities very broadly. So in particular, I mentioned the three categories, recent entrants. Recent entrants are defined by DHS to mean anyone who is apprehended within 3 years of entering the United States, as well as anyone apprehended by CBP, regardless of the timeline. Immigration obstructionists are defined as anyone who's ever been ordered deported, everyone who's ever been ordered deported, as well as anyone who fails to appear at an immigration hearing. And criminals are defined as anyone who's ever been convicted of any crime. So those are all sort of a broad definition of those terms. So what this table does is two things. One thing, is, in this first row, what we look at is if DHS were to strictly adhere to its enforcement priorities, meaning that anybody who fell outside those priorities would benefit from discretion and not be deported, how would that change the enforcement numbers? And this table only looks at the ICE removal cases. We can't look at the CBP cases here because we don't have enough information about them. So what we can see here is that removals would have fallen, the ICE removals would have fallen from about 2.9 million to about 2.7 million, a 7% reduction. What the rest of the table does is ask the same question, but if the priorities were defined somewhat more narrowly. So instead of all criminals, what if we only focused on people convicted of non-immigration crimes? Or what if we only focused on people who have been convicted of violent crimes? And the way to read this table is, the easy way to read it is to basically look at these numbers and compare them to this. So what you can see is that excluding immigration crimes from the priorities doesn't actually move the needle. I mean, when you look at in detail, it only changes the removal numbers by 7,000 over the entire 11-year period. And and I'll say something about the reason in a moment. So we don't really see these numbers go up until we look at significantly narrowing the criminal categories that we're going to focus on by not emphasizing level 3 ICE offenders or by not emphasizing violent criminals. All of these other numbers are actually are smaller than we expected. So that was something that we were interested in and we looked into. And one of the reasons for that is that most people who fall into one of ICE's priority categories fall into more than one of ICE's priority categories. So the example I was just about to say something about, the immigration crimes, most people convicted of an immigration crime are apprehended at the border and convicted of an immigration crime. So they're not just seen as an immigration crime priority, they're also seen as a recent border crosser. And same with reinstatements. Most people reinstated are apprehended at the border, and they may also have been convicted of an immigration crime. So a lot of people fall into all three priority categories or fall into two of the three priority categories. In the Obama years, 58% of all removals fell into more than one priority category. So that's one reason why the numbers in that previous table were a little smaller than we expected. So in this table, we looked at some more complicated scenarios where, what if we changed more than one of these priorities at the same time? And what you can see is that, I mean, this does show that removals would fall more, you know, which is what we'd expect. And I'll just sort of talk you through a couple of cases because it's a lot of numbers to throw at you. So what this row is showing is that if DHS no longer focused on nonviolent criminals as a top enforcement priority and they no longer focused on 10-year-old removal orders, didn't consider people who had been removed 10 years previously to be a top priority, then we would project that removals would have fallen by about 17% over the previous 11 years. What this row is showing you is that if DHS no longer emphasized non-DUI traffic crimes and defined recent entrants to mean somebody who came in the last 1 year instead of 3 years, removals would have fallen by 9% versus 7 or 8% for either of those changes by themselves. The most sort of far-reaching set of changes that we model is to de-emphasize nonviolent criminals to deprioritize people who entered more than a year ago and people with 10-year-old or older removal orders, and that would have reduced removals by about 19%. So these numbers are a little bigger than the previous table. One of our takeaways is still that we were surprised that playing with the enforcement priorities or, you know, doing these thought experiments with the enforcement priorities, thinking about the enforcement priorities, doesn't produce a larger reduction in numbers. And so one reason is because most removals are priorities for more than one reason. A second reason is that most removals fall into core DHS interests. You know, most people removed from the border are apprehended at the border within 3 days of entering. And those are people that DHS views as an enforcement priority. Most people removed from the interior have been convicted either of violent crimes or of drug crimes or of DUI. And those are people who, you know, are viewed as sort of core enforcement priorities. So, you know, for that reason, changing the enforcement priorities doesn't push the numbers down that much. And this sort of relates to a third point, which is that if we think about exercising prosecutorial discretion during the enforcement process as a form of executive action designed to reduce removal numbers, it's important to recognize that discretion during the enforcement process has a different kind of impact on immigrant communities than an affirmative DACA-style program in which unauthorized immigrants would actively apply for relief. Discretion during enforcement is less concrete, and it's more difficult for immigrant communities to observe because most people who could potentially benefit from discretion during enforcement don't ever experience that benefit because they never enter the DHS enforcement system. So if you think about an unauthorized immigrant who lives in the United States and never commits a crime, they just don't interact with DHS for the most part. And so they're never going to see DHS's discretion in action. So that's how this type of discretion should work. It means that ICE is focusing on high priority cases instead of, you know, these people who would benefit from discretion. But it also means that the psychological impact of discretion during enforcement and the politics of any changes to the enforcement priorities are quite different than those for an application-based DACA-style program where people would affirmatively seek relief. So I'm going to pause there. I'll just remind you my three key takeaways. Stark differences between border and interior enforcement across the board. The vast majority of current removals meet DHS's enforcement priorities, and changes to the priorities would likely have a modest impact on the total removal numbers.
Okay. All right. Hope that gives you a good summation of an enormous amount of numbers, more of which you will find in the report itself, but they actually do really add up to these broad conclusions. So with that, let me turn to you, Rebecca.
Thank you, Doris, and thank you, Mark, and good morning to everyone. I just want to thank MPI for inviting me to participate in today's discussion. I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to discuss some of GAO's work, looking at some of the issues and topics, or related to some of the issues and topics that are raised in MPI's report, which are being issued today. Before I turn to my remarks on some of GAO's more specific reports, I just wanted to give you a little bit more background on me and also who GAO is, in case some of you may not be as familiar about who we are as an agency. So as Doris mentioned, I am a director in GAO's Homeland Security and Justice team, and in that capacity, I lead our work on border security and immigration issues. Now, GAO as an agency is located in the legislative branch. We are sometimes referred to as the investigative arm of Congress or the congressional watchdog. And so in that capacity, we examine how federal taxpayer dollars are spent, and we examine how government programs and initiatives and efforts operate. Most of our work is done at the request of chairs or ranking members of committees of jurisdiction in Congress, or our work can also be mandated by committee reports or public laws. Our reports are available on our website, which is gao.gov, and many of our reports contain recommendations to agencies that we're reviewing, on changes or improvements that they can make to their programs. On the border security and immigration work in particular, we've covered a range of topics. On the border security side, we've looked at issues like goals and metrics for assessing border security efforts. We've also done work looking at DHS's management and oversight of efforts to acquire and deploy surveillance technologies along the border. And we've also done work looking at how different agencies that have some responsibility for border security efforts coordinate and collaborate on their efforts. On the immigration side, we've done work looking at various enforcement efforts, including ICE oversight of schools that admit foreign students. We've also done work looking at overstay enforcement issues. And on the immigration benefits side, we've done work looking at USCIS's processes and systems for adjudicating immigration benefits. And we've also done some work looking at employment verification issues. So I just wanted to share those remarks by way of introduction, just to give you a flavor of who GAO is as an agency and sort of the range of work we've done more specifically on border security and immigration issues. For today's discussion, I want to focus my remarks really on two or three key reports that relate to some of the issues and topics that are raised in MPI's report. The first report that I'm going to spend most of my time discussing is a report that GAO issued in the summer of 2012 on the Secure Communities Program. And in that report, we present some data and trends on removals of aliens identified by the Secure Communities Program, which I think are related to some of the trends and data that Mark just discussed in MPI's report. So I'll spend the bulk of my time talking about that report. I'll spend a little bit less time talking about a report that GAO issued in 2011 looking at data and statistics on criminal aliens who are incarcerated in federal, state, and local prisons. And I think that data is relevant just to give you kind of a sense of what were some of the trends and data that we saw in that population of aliens. And so those are the two key reports that I'll focus on. And so let me turn first to our work on the Secure Communities Program. So as you're all probably aware, the Secure Communities Program is one of ICE's programs for identifying potentially removable aliens who are arrested by state or local law enforcement agencies. Under the program, when an individual is arrested by the state or local law enforcement agency, the individual's fingerprints are taken and automatically checked against federal fingerprint databases to include DHS's fingerprint system. If there is a match, ICE conducts some additional checks and determines whether or not to request that the law enforcement agency hold the individual so that ICE can take custody for further enforcement action. So as I get into my remarks now on some of the trends and data I'll present, I just want to provide one or two definitions for some terms and concepts. For our report, a criminal alien is a non-citizen in the United States who may be present on a lawful basis or not, who has been convicted of a crime. And it's important to note that a criminal alien lawfully in the U.S. may be removable depending on the nature of the particular offense for which the alien was convicted. So I'm going to talk about a couple of sets of data that we present in our report. So the first set of data I want to talk about is trends that we looked at in terms of ICE's enforcement actions under the Secure Communities Program. And we looked at removals of aliens identified by the Secure Communities Program relative to all ICE removals during the time period of our study. And what we found was that the Secure Communities Program accounted for an increasing percentage of all ICE removals during the period that we looked at, which was fiscal year 2009 through the first 6 months of fiscal year 2012. And so we found, for example, that Secure Communities was responsible for identifying about 20% of the approximately 400,000 aliens that ICE removed in fiscal year 2011, up from approximately 4% of the aliens that ICE removed in fiscal year 2009. Now, we also looked at some data on the Secure Communities Program in terms of the type of offense that aliens who were identified by the program had. And what we found was that the majority of aliens who were removed and identified by the Secure Communities Program had been convicted of a criminal offense. Again, during the time period that we were looking at, which is October 2008 through March 2012, about 74% of aliens removed and identified by the Securities Program had been convicted of a criminal offense. That is either the offense that led to their identification under Secure Communities or they had a record of a conviction for a previous offense. 21% of aliens removed did not have a criminal conviction known to ICE prior to their removal, but were identified as one of ICE's other removal priorities, such as aliens who were fugitives or who reentered the U.S. illegally after reentry. After removal. The remaining 5% also did not have a known criminal conviction prior to their removal, but they were nonetheless removable because, for example, they entered the country without inspection or they had violated their terms of admission. To further break down these data, we found that 27% of the aliens who were removed by ICE after being identified by Secure Communities were convicted of level one offenses, 17% were convicted of level two offenses, and 30% were convicted of level three offenses. So level one includes aliens convicted of aggravated felonies, or basically two or more felonies. Level two includes aliens convicted of any felony and or three or more what are generally referred to as misdemeanors. And level three includes aliens who were convicted of offenses that are punishable by less than 1 year. So in addition to those data, the 26% of aliens who were removed by ICE after being identified by the Secure Communities Program that had no confirmed criminal convictions, 18% were prior removals or returns, 5% were entries without inspection, or they were visa violators, and the other 3% were ICE fugitives. So that just gives you some sense of the data and trends that we saw looking specifically at removals under the Secure Communities Program during the time frame that we studied. In addition, we also looked at variation across fiscal years in the proportion of aliens removed according to their criminal level under the Secure Communities Program. So, for example, we found that there was a decrease in the proportion of convicted level three offenders removed from about 40% of total removals in fiscal year 2009 to 26% during the first half of fiscal year 2012. And we also found that there was some change among level two offenders as well. And part of the part of what ICE attributed to those changes were that ICE had continued to prioritize its resources to focus on the identification and removal of aliens convicted of felonies, and also that ICE did have some redefinition of its criminal offense levels between fiscal years 2010 and 2011. So in closing on this report, we did not make any recommendations to DHS having to do with the data or trends that we reported, but we did make recommendations to the department related to how it was managing its contracting process for updating or modernizing its systems used as part of the Secure Communities Program, and we also made a recommendation related to DHS developing a workforce plan related to using resources under the program, and DHS concurred with those recommendations and is acting on them. So let me now briefly turn to a report we issued in 2011 on criminal alien statistics. These data were last updated through fiscal year 2010, but I think they provide some useful information for the discussion today on the numbers of incarcerated criminal aliens and the types of offenses for which they were arrested or convicted. So let me get into some of the trends that are identified in our report. First, we found that the number of criminal aliens incarcerated in federal prisons increased about 7% from 51,000 in fiscal year 2005 to about 55,000 in fiscal year 2010. And for context, the criminal alien population as a total of the federal total federal inmate population has remained relatively constant since 2001 at about 25 to 27%. We also used, as part of our study, a random sample of 1,000 criminal aliens and made some estimates based on that sample. And so, for example, we estimated that criminal aliens had an average of 7 arrests. About 65% were arrested at least once for an immigration offense, and about 50% were arrested at least once for a drug offense. Immigration, drugs, and traffic violations accounted for about half of arrest offenses, and about 90% of the criminal aliens sentenced in federal court in fiscal year 2009 were convicted of immigration and or drug-related offenses. So there's more data in that report should anybody be interested. I won't get into all of the data now for the sake of time, but that report is available on our website. The last report, very quickly, if I can, Doris, just call your attention to, but I won't make remarks on today, is in 2012, GAO issued a report looking at data on Border Patrol enforcement efforts, specifically along the border. While our data did not include removals, which are part of MPI's report that's being released today, we did look at other data on Border Patrol enforcement efforts, including data on illegal entries, apprehensions, recidivist rates, and so on. And so I would commend that report to you as well, should you have any interest in some of the other or some different data on Border Patrol enforcement efforts along the southwest border. So again, thank you, Doris and Mark, for inviting me.
Okay, thank you very much, Rebecca. I hope everybody had their coffee this morning, because I know we are giving you a barrage of numbers. But we decided we would make this be a research panel because there really is a lot of information that is pertinent to an issue that is very important in the public policy discussion. And we're going to continue on that trajectory with Mark, although his work takes a slightly different angle of vision. So Mark, let me turn the microphone over to you now.
Hey, thanks, Doris. And thanks also to Mark and to Randy Capps as well for bringing me here today. I work as an enforcement fellow at the American Immigration Council. We're a nonpartisan organization whose mission is to shape a more rational immigration policy. And as part of that work, I do work on deportation and detention, as MPI does as well. I'd like to do three things in my brief time. One is to emphasize the importance of this paper and MPI's work over the last couple years in helping to understand modern U.S. immigration enforcement. Secondly, given this data that's been put out, to look into the future and forecast some of the coming debates, policy and legislative. And third, to briefly describe a paper on immigration detention that MPI has asked me and my co-author Robert Kulish at the University of Maryland to write, which complements their work on deportation. So first, this is a very valuable paper, and it's part of a series of valuable papers that MPI has done over the last couple years that examine the enforcement system that Congress has funded, and particularly in this paper, DHS prioritization of that funding under different administrations. But it's worth noting the key driver here is congressional funding. As MPI's 2013 report, Rise of a Formidable Machinery, which Doris and others put out, the U.S. spends more on immigration enforcement than all other law enforcement agencies combined. That's $18 billion to CBP and ICE in fiscal year 2014. So this administration has been trying to walk a tightrope in between choosing between tough and humane enforcement, as Mark set out in an earlier paper this year. But at these funding levels, any administration would have to walk a tightrope in choosing between those sometimes competing goals. So let me summarize a little bit about what this data and this paper tells us about the policy ahead. First, one of the important things that Mark's paper brings out is how the Obama administration has shifted its priorities to border enforcement from interior enforcement. And moreover, from this data, how they're very different systems in the processes they use and in the individuals involved. At the border, the processes are generally non-judicial removals out of court. At the interior, they are generally in-court removals. At the border, removals are rising. They're generally of non-criminals or of criminals only for immigration crimes. Most are apprehended soon after entry. At the interior, there's a shrinking share of removals. They are mostly of individuals with criminal convictions. They are mostly apprehended after some time in the United States, over 1 year. That said, both border and interior enforcement involve difficult policy choices and some inevitable human impact. At the border, you may have border crossers that are returning to join family, particularly reflected in the reinstatements of a prior removal order. You may have asylum seekers that are seeking to join family. Particularly this year, we've seen that from Central America, and their process generally through expedited removal. So border enforcement still has impact inside the border. And removal through these summary out-of-court processes has attracted criticism for due process concerns. And my organization, the Council, has been one of the organizations that has raised those issues. Secondly, in the interior, most have criminal convictions. The majority are not serious convictions. It is a higher percentage than it is at the border, but it is not a majority. Moreover, many have deep U.S. ties, and even more so today than a decade ago. The Pew Hispanic Trust has put out information this year that shows that of the 11 million unauthorized, the median time they've spent in the country is now 13 years. Only 15% have been here less than 5 years. 38%, 4 million about, live with U.S. citizen children. So even with the shifting of these priorities to effectuate a more humane enforcement policy, there is inevitable human impact. Now, these priorities are not new, and as Mark sets out, DHS, along with the legacy INS, has always focused on these priorities. And the 2011 Morton Memo priorities are in many ways a logical extension of the priorities that Commissioner Meisner effectuated in her time at the INS. But one possibility that is raised by this data is that with such high funding levels, it may be getting harder practically to have such robust enforcement without raising difficult choices, without deporting the harder cases, for lack of a better word. And notably as well, among these priorities, the least of the priorities is increasingly occupying more of DHS's resources. And let me explain what I mean by that. John Morton's memo prioritized public safety threats as number one, understandably. And within that, he prioritized serious violent criminals over minor criminals. But as this paper shows, most that are convicted of a crime are the not violent or not serious criminals. And an increasing percentage are immigration convictions. Secondly, the Morton memo prioritized immigration obstructionists. And within that, he prioritized public safety threats as well as those with a prior deportation order. But we're seeing increasing numbers of reinstatements. And so as DHS makes serious efforts to effectuate these priorities, and within them the highest of their priorities, in practice they are increasingly deporting the least of the worst, so to speak. So these priorities will inevitably have human impact and inevitably draw public scrutiny. Now, that said, I think these priorities are likely to remain through the Obama administration and very likely into the next, particularly because it's getting harder for ICE to accomplish interior removals for two main reasons. One is the impact of the immigration courts being underfunded. These enforcement funding increases have not been accompanied by commensurate court funding increases. So there are record-breaking court backlogs. The average case now takes over a year and a half to be processed in immigration court. For removal numbers to stay steady year over year, if that was the goal, it would be almost practically impossible to do that without accomplishing more removals out of court, simply because they're quicker. Through non-judicial removals, it's possible to apprehend someone in FY14 and remove them in FY14 in a way that is not very likely in court. Secondly, the impact of local noncompliance with ICE enforcement is making it much harder for ICE to accomplish interior removals in the same way. Cities, counties, and states across the nation are adopting noncompliance policies. Rather remarkably, many are refusing to now turn over any person with a criminal charge to ICE. Not even minor criminals, any criminal charge. This is now 250 counties across the U.S. ICE could respond to this by conducting raids in the same localities that have expressed this noncompliance that might engender further opposition through the political process. So for those reasons, it's likely that the state of affairs Mark describes will remain over the next couple of years with enforcement shifted to the border, with the major exception of depending on if the administration chooses to provide some affirmative administrative relief this fall, which remains to be seen. So the further questions looking forward, one may be, is Congress getting what it wants as it funds enforcement and as DHS prioritizes its allocation of that funding? Or put another way, as the picture becomes clearer through reports such as Mark's today and MPI's work over the last couple of years, will the American public agree with the political branch's decisions, Congress and the executive branch? After these 2 decades since 1996 of very robust enforcement at high funding levels, it's becoming harder for DHS to draw a bright line between removing those with the least claims to stay in the United States, whether legal, equitable, or moral, and exercising discretion over the most. As Mark says in the report, DHS lacks the capacity to precisely fine-tune enforcement. But any law enforcement agency of this size would lack that capacity. So as we look ahead, there's an unavoidable impact on those inside the border. The enforcement net remains wide, and in some cases becomes wider. But we have an unauthorized population with deeper ties. We have studies, academic studies, that are showing that programs such as Secure Communities have little impact on U.S. crime, albeit impact on unlawful migration, but little impact on U.S. crime. And we're seeing local political opposition to increased enforcement. So one of the questions is that if congressional funding remains constant at these levels, I think one is, are there any policy choices that this administration or a future one could make without impacting residents inside the United States, many who have a vote? Or another way of putting it is that the flashpoint going forward for change may be Congress. The administration's decision to shift enforcement to the border may deflect some of that political criticism, but perhaps not all of it. And more broadly still, one of the questions is, as we look forward, will the political dynamics of immigration enforcement change as the political dynamics surrounding criminal justice have changed over the last years? For decades, we've had a political consensus that has supported tough-on-crime policies. Recently, that has changed in a bipartisan way. We have Senator Cory Booker and Senator Rand Paul introducing bills on sentencing reform. We have a bipartisan House Judiciary Task Force on overcriminalization chaired by Representative Sensenbrenner. Now, in the immigration realm, there has not been the same sustained widespread opposition to harsh consequences for non-citizen minor criminals as there has been in the criminal justice world. But we see around the country the jurisdictions, many with high immigrant populations, are starting to evaluate the trade-offs of expanded immigration enforcement and starting to register opposition through the political process. Now, I think one question is whether that local opposition will register at the federal level and particularly in the appropriations process, which may be fundamentally the main driver of the policies that this data describes. And again, shifting resources to the border where enforcement is less visible in communities may deflect some of that criticism. It may not be that the same political opposition emerging at the local level in certain cities rises up to the federal level of communities registering their opposition in the appropriations process, but that may be where the flashpoint is. Lastly, I thought I'd mention a couple words about the paper on detention that MPI has asked me to write. And again, this is with Robert Kulish, who is a political scientist at University of Maryland and director of their Law and Society program. It complements MPI's work on deportation with data on detention, which is a substantial part of ICE's interior budget, $2 billion. And it provides similarly granular data that allows us to evaluate ICE's choices regarding detention. We gain this information through Freedom of Information Act responses regarding ICE's new risk assessment tool. This is a computerized tool that evaluates flight and public safety risk and issues a recommendation whether to detain or not. ICE began using it in 2013. We have several hundred samples from Baltimore. So using this data, we can evaluate who ICE decides to detain or not in greater detail. We can see ICE's recommendations as to flight risk and public safety. We can see collected criminal history. And in really groundbreaking fashion, we can see personal history. This data records family ties, whether someone has a U.S. citizen spouse or child, whether someone has a stable address, whether someone has work authorization. And it allows us to provide greater detail to tell some of the stories in even further detail, I think, and complement what Mark has done. For example, of those with criminal convictions, are they more stable in fact, even if they might have a lesser claim to stay in the United States because they've committed a crime during their time here? Do they have a greater claim in another sense because they have longstanding family? And it will tell us something also about the utility of mandatory detention laws, because it will give us ICE's own evaluation of the risk of people at arrest, even those subject to mandatory detention. With that, I'd like to thank Doris and Mark and Randy again for having me here, and hand it back to Doris.
Okay, thanks very much, Mark. That was a not purposeful, but still somewhat of a teaser for things to come. So we'll be continuing, of course, to be working on these kinds of issues, and this work that Mark is doing should be particularly interesting as another follow-up. Okay, we turn to Q&A now, and I'm going to, since we're streaming and recording, I want to be sure that you wait till the mic comes to you. But when it does come to you, please give us your name and affiliation and then answer your ask your question. So I'm ready for hands. Over here.
Slides that you put up did not appear to be in the report itself, and I'm just wondering if those will all be available, for example, on the on MPI's website for reference purposes. And the other question that I have basically is there any way of knowing, in terms of immigration offenses for deportation, how many of those involve such things as alien smuggling as opposed to simply being in violation of the immigration law?
I think we'll post the PowerPoint on the website. So yes to your first question. The short answer to your second question is also yes. That data is in, that level of detail is in my data set. I don't have the exact numbers in my head, but I can tell you that the overwhelming majority of the immigration crimes are illegal entry and illegal reentry. I can't remember if that's on the order of 85%, 90%, 95%, but it's somewhere in that range are illegal entry, illegal reentry. The other crimes that are included in the immigration crime category are document fraud and there's a smuggling offense in there, an alien smuggling offense in there. But the great majority of them are entry and reentry. So crossing the border, being apprehended while crossing the border.
I think I saw him in the back, yes.
Hi, I'm Mari Quenamon. I'm from the Southeast Asia Resource Action Center, CRAC. The majority of people deported in CRAC's communities are originally refugees, Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam, and are green card holders, usually who get in trouble with the law when they're teenagers or young adults. I'm wondering, in any of the data sets that you're looking at, including from this FOIA request, can you look at the impact of these of this enforcement regime on green card holders, maybe even those who originally entered as refugees, and in general, long-time residents with legal status?
So we would not be able to see if they entered as refugees or not. We do have a field in the data that is a self-reported green card holder. You know, ICE asks people, you know, what's your status? And if people answer they have a green card, that's how it gets recorded. So, you know, it's not confirmed, but you know, we wouldn't expect that number is going to be underreported. You would expect perhaps it's overreported, not underreported. And we found surprisingly few green card holders in the data set. I mean, it was on the order of around 5,000 a year out of, you know, around 300,000 or 400,000 removals a year. And, you know, again, I apologize, I don't have all the exact numbers in my head, but, you know, I'm happy to follow up with both of y'all and give you exact percentages. But it was a surprisingly, you know, I was expecting to find a little bit bigger number than we found. And you know, legally, the reason that green card holders would be deportable is if they've committed a removable offense. So and we did find that the people who identified as green card holders had been, you know, there was a pretty high correlation that they had been convicted of crimes that looked like they would have been removable offenses. So we didn't find in the data, we didn't find evidence of green card holders being deported without being convicted of a crime.
Mark, do you have an addition to that?
Sure. So in our
whether they're at risk of persecution. And there is not a checkbox for LPR status in that risk assessment. Whether they should be is another question, but there is not. There is a checkbox for work authorization, which may be related, although not exactly the same as green card status.
Okay, other hands? Here in the front.
Yeah, thank you. Especially in connection with the interior removals, no? And this is probably for both of you. One of the things is I was looking at numbers, recent numbers, and there's been an increase, a surprising increase of removals of nationals from Caribbean countries, Jamaica, Haiti, Dominican Republic, and I don't know if there's any specific reason for that. And the other thing is I don't know if you've been able to correlate ICE detainers with the trends with removal, so, and that's probably part of the work you're doing right now. No? So,
I didn't notice that trend, and I mean it's something that we could look at. It's not something that jumped out at me in looking, you know, in spending a lot of time looking at these data, but it could certainly be there. You know what we you know what comes out clearly in our data is within the interior that people convicted of a crime are a rising share of those interior removals. So, you know, I don't know if that could have been part of a driver. We don't, you know, I didn't really find another interior trend that was obvious to me. And we unfortunately don't have detainer data in our data set, but that's something that we'd be interested in looking at. And I'll just let me just say one other thing. You know, the ICE EID data set. One of the other things that we were frustrated by in this data set is the Enforcement Integrated Database, the main ICE removal database, isn't designed to really track exactly how people flow into the system. So there's an arrest program listed, but you know, a lot of those arrests are by the Criminal Alien Program, which is, you know, the biggest part of ICE's removal operation. And you can't see whether somebody came into the system because they were identified through secure communities or because they were identified through one of CAP's prison-based screening programs where they screen people, you know, post-sentencing while they're incarcerated, or whether it's a CAP team, you know, because CAP has task forces also. So you can't, you know, the data don't give you clear information about sort of at that level of detail about including, for example, whether a detainer was issued.
Mark?
So that said, at the American Immigration Council, we're doing some research now that actually gets at some of those questions Mark answered, by which program someone came into the system, whether it's CAPS or CURE communities. And that's something we're looking to put out in the next several months.
Okay. Here.
Hey, Christian from Matt.org. Besides those causes that you think that it's attributed to where they're putting priorities, did you identify any triggers probably in the past or any patterns in which we could start identifying some of the of these cases? And I was also going to ask you in regard to the border removals, are they also proportional to immigration patterns? Is there anything that we can identify 5 years ago that could be used to understand now?
So let me, I'm glad you asked that second question because it reminds me of something that I was supposed to add to my comments and I forgot to, which is that the border removals are not predicted by apprehensions. And what I mean is that during the period that border removals have increased, apprehensions have been falling. And the Border Patrol and DHS have had a purposeful policy of placing a higher share of apprehensions in formal removal. And this is something we talked a lot about in our April report. But border removals are going up while border apprehensions are going down. And you know what's driving that is that an increasing share of apprehensions are being formally removed rather than permitted to voluntarily return as they had been in the past. So historically, most people apprehended at the border are sort of put on a bus or put on a plane and sent home with sort of no additional consequences. And there's been a systematic effort to instead increasingly formally remove people, which makes them ineligible for a visa to come back, and in many cases to charge them with illegal entry or illegal reentry, which makes them, you know, convicted of a U.S. crime and potentially subject to jail time in the U.S. So that's been an enforcement strategy, and that's really been the biggest driver of increased removals at the border, despite falling apprehension numbers. In the interior, we know that most people apprehended in the interior are identified through, one of the criminal justice-related programs, either through 287G or Secure Communities or another criminal alien program. The effort at the ICE field offices is to, prioritize and people who've been convicted of a crime, but also people who have previously been deported. And to a lesser extent, people who can't document, how long they've been in the U.S. Those are going to be the priorities. Overall, we know that the unauthorized population in the U.S. has fallen by about 1 million since 2007. So the available pool of unauthorized immigrants is going down. Which may be part of what's driving the interior numbers down, but the number of people passing through ICE's filter is going up, because of the universal implementation of secure communities. So ICE has access to a larger and larger potential enforcement pool, and they're using it, fairly selectively, particularly in the last couple of years, is what the data show.
Over here.
Thank you. Matt Graham from the Bipartisan Policy Center. I've looked at similar data, maybe the same data set, and one thing that struck me is that starting in fiscal 2007, there are a substantial number of returns in the data. I think the code is voluntary return witness, and it was on the order of 10%, sometimes more, of the removals. So I was wondering, did you all examine or notice this? And if so, what do you make of it?
I think I saw you sneak in late. And what I said before you got here is we excluded all those returns from our analysis, mostly in order to be able to sort of look at a consistent trend. So we only focused on the removals. The reason that returns appear in the data set in 2007 is that prior to 2007, returns were not counted among the ICE removals. So, it's not that they start increasing in 2007. It's that there are zero before 2007, and they represent about 10% of all ICE deportations after 2007. And that was a counting rule a decision that was made at the end of the Bush administration to begin counting those witnessed returns as ICE removals. So that's been a source of confusion and among some of the people looking at the data. ICE only counts, the only cases that are included in ICE's data set are, as you said, the witnessed returns. So if they give somebody a voluntary return and can't confirm that that person actually departed, they don't get counted. But we decided to only focus on the removals. I did look a little bit at the returns. The returns, as you would expect, are less likely to have been convicted of a crime. That's the main thing I can tell you about the returns is that they appear to be, consistent with ICE's discretion rules, that they appear to be the lower priority cases. But as you said, it's about 10% of the cases. So we were more interested in having the trend over time than complicating the analysis.
Any more than it already is.
Yeah.
right there.
Hi, Raj Bardeville, York University in Canada, Toronto. I'm wondering if the data that you have at your disposal, does it have details on where they come from, which particular region in the country? and whether the analysis takes into account the concentration of people coming from a particular part of the country, and how then the information is relayed to the region back to those countries. Thank you.
We have data about where people came from, what country they came from, but only at the national level, not, you know, we have their citizenship and birth countries. And we have data on the port of exit, where they were deported through, but we don't have data on where they were apprehended, other than, you know, by program, by, you know, CBP versus ICE, or more detailed data about where they came from. But, you know, something that we'd be very interested in is being able to disaggregate, you know, within the U.S. about where people are being apprehended. But, you know, obviously DHS has that data, but we don't have that data.
And I take it your question is where they originated, which state in Mexico, which region in Guatemala. Is that what you were getting at?
What I meant was, even within Mexico or Guatemala, there might be certain poorer regions or
exactly.
insecure regions. And if that's the case, how there is a dialogue yeah. between, you know, it's not just sending them and
right.
then hoping that the problem will be resolved. The problem
the
is not today, going to
today,
be. So is there any two-way dialogue at the political level to say these are people coming from a specific coastal area or insecure area or areas where there are drugs or whatever, and what sort of policies can be put in place then to contain?
I mean, I can tell you that, you know, with respect to Mexico, most people are repatriated to the closest port of entry. There is a program, there used to be a program called the Mexico Interior Repatriation Program. The new program is called the Interior Repatriation Initiative, the IRI, which does involve bipartisan, binational coordination through which certain Mexicans are deported by air back to Mexico City and then by bus back to their hometown. It's a pretty small share of total removals. I don't remember exactly how many the IRI has managed this year. Did any of y'all know? It's small. It's in the, you know, the few thousands, the tens of thousands. Do you?
Matt has a program where we find job opportunities for people that are being repatriated in Mexico. And we have statistics of the cities that they're going to. And, of course, Michoacán, Sinaloa, and those troubled areas are where most of the people are going through. We'd be more than happy to post something about it on our website. I'll try to make sure that it's up by tomorrow. By Monday.
Can I just add one thing to the previous point that Mark was making about sort of where aliens who are identified for removal are removed from. In our report, and again, it's just focused on the Secure Communities Program, which is a smaller population, but we actually include a map that shows the data by state on the arrest locations of aliens who were identified for removal through the Secure Communities Program for the time period that we studied. So if anybody's interested in the data on a state-by-state basis, again, just as it relates to Secure Communities, we do include some of that information in our report as well. So I just wanted to add that.
Okay, all right, thanks. Others in the front?
Samar Chatterjee from SAFE Foundation. Could you, a couple of questions. One is the term reinstatement, and if you could explain that, what it is. And the second one is there was a mention that there are some counties which refuse to cooperate with, I don't know, nowadays they don't use the term INS, so ICE, and what the reasons could be. And a third, you didn't focus on the prison conditions with how these immigrant populations that are held by ICE, and what was the reason for that?
So I'll try to answer those, and then if others want to also add their answers. So a reinstatement is a non-citizen who has been formerly removed, who's been subject to a removal order because a judge ordered them removed or because they were apprehended at the border and formally removed. If they are subsequently apprehended again within the United States, then DHS can can reinstate that removal order, turn it back on, and formally remove them again without any opportunity to appear before a judge or to petition for relief to make a case that they've got equities that would allow them to stay in the United States. In terms of why some communities are opting out of secure communities, I mean, this has been a sort of a long story. When secure communities was first rolled out, it was presented as a voluntary program that ICE negotiated agreements with states to include them in it. Later, ICE decided that they didn't need to have an agreement from the localities because, you know, the heart of secure communities is communication between ICE and the Department of, between DHS and the Department of Justice to share federal information. And then when DHS determines that a removable immigrant has been arrested, the local ICE field office can request that the arresting agency hold the person for ICE to pick them up. Some communities don't want to participate in that because I guess there are two main reasons. One reason is there are concerns that they don't get reimbursed to hold people. So there's fiscal, you know, it costs money for local jurisdictions to hold people for ICE. But I think that the more fundamental reason is that there are concerns that the program is being used to hold and to deport people who aren't public safety risks. And so this has an impact on the local immigrant communities. It strains relations between immigrant communities and local law enforcement. So law enforcement agencies that want to do community policing have a hard time, you know, maintaining good relationships with immigrant communities if they are deporting members of those communities who may not be viewed as a priority. I think that those are sort of the two main concerns are the cost effects and the impact on communities and concerns that the program is not fine-tuned to only focus on high priority cases. I don't know, do others want to add that? And I can say something about detention also, but do others want to say anything else about?
I would just say on your question regarding sort of detention conditions, GAO has issued two reports related to immigration detention standards issue. We issued a report last year looking at how ICE addresses sexual abuse and assault in immigration detention facilities. And last week, we issued a report looking at how ICE manages detention facility costs and standards. And so those reports are available on our website. I'm happy to discuss findings if anyone has any questions. But we have done some work looking at issues related to standards in immigration detention facilities.
Okay, and we have a report on the detainer issue also at the American Immigration Council, although I think Mark summarized it very well.
Yes, here.
Hi, I'm Brenda Stefan from the Inter-American Development Bank. In terms of the removals of Mexicans, you've mentioned the IRI, also the repatriation through the closest port of entry, and there was also ADIP, the Aliens Transfer Program. I was wondering whether you've looked into recidivism rates and whether there is a link in between recidivism and these three different ways of removing Mexicans. Thank you.
So we don't do that in this report. I mean, that's something that CBP has been looking, you know, systematically at. So CBP, through its consequence delivery system, tracks recidivism rates just at the border, not people who are apprehended in the U.S. within the U.S. And is able to describe recidivism for people who are voluntarily returned, people who are formally removed either after appearing before a judge or through reinstatement or expedited removal, and then also looking at ATAP and I guess also at the interior back when they had the interior repatriation right. And they have found that, and also people who face criminal charges. I mean, generally what they have found is that that people who are formally removed have lower recidivism rates than people who are voluntarily returned. People who face criminal charges have lower recidivism rates than people who just have formal removal. I don't think they've published any of those data, but but they, some of those data have been published in some other sources. I know there was a Congressional Research Service report that came out in 2013 that I did when I worked at CRS that has some of those data that CBP made available at the time. ATEP doesn't appear in the data to have doesn't appear to reduce recidivism rates. It's a little bit confusing to look at ATEP because it's always combined with some other, removal strategy. But I think that's, ATEP is somewhat controversial, partly for that reason. And then also because the human cost of ATEP can be pretty high because people get deported back to a community where they don't have a connection. And, maybe that, so it's a controversial program.
And so for the purposes of understanding, define ATEP.
ATEP is the Alien Transfer Exit Program, and that's a program. So normally, unauthorized Mexicans or removable Mexicans are deported back to the closest port of entry. Under ATEP, they are intentionally put on a bus. So people apprehended in Arizona may be deported through Texas or through Arizona, and the effort is to disrupt the smuggling networks and to make it more difficult for people to re-enter, because typically people who are deported back to the closest port of entry may reconnect with the smuggler who helped them enter, and just more generally may be able to attempt re-entry more easily than somebody who is deported far away. So that's what ATEP is designed to do. It's an expensive program to, send people to different parts of the country. And immigrant rights groups have argued, I think, convincingly that, it really creates difficult circumstances for people who may be deported, to high crime communities, and they may lose their documents and or not have money when they arrive. And so there's some real vulnerabilities that result from ATEP. So it's a controversial program, I think, for that reason.
In the front, Joanne.
Thank you. I have two questions. First one from Mark Rosenblum. Just wanted to drill down a little bit more on the final paragraph in your executive summary that any proposed changes to the enforcement priorities would result in only modest reductions in overall removals. Would that make any difference if the administration extended the priorities and prosecutorial discretion guidance to CBP?
No, and modest is, modest is not a very precise word. I mean, I think it's not hard to describe a scenario where you could see removals go down by 10 or 15% or maybe close to 20%, some of the scenarios that we described. But certainly, CBP has, as we described in our last report, there's been a sea change in how CBP does enforcement just over the last, less than 10 years, from mostly voluntary returns to overwhelmingly formal removals. So, if what you're talking about specifically is reducing formal removals, you could reduce that substantially if you decided to, go back to an era where you're going to voluntary return most people, which may or may not be governed by, which you may or may not choose to tie to enforcement priorities. But having said that, the data do suggest that the great majority of people that CBP apprehends, they apprehend within 3 days and especially within 2 weeks of entry. So if people apprehended within 2 weeks of entry are going to be viewed as a top enforcement priority, then, that's most of what CBP does. So
thank you very much. And then my second question is for Mark and for Doris. And when you were saying that congressional spending and appropriations is the primary driver of the deportation system. And Doris, I was wondering if you could comment on that, given your years as former INS commissioner, whether or not the actual, high congressional appropriations really has made the exercise of prosecutorial discretion much more limited in what this current administration can do. And I want to kind of push one premise here is in that I want us to question whether, a certain amount of congressional spending necessarily means that has to be 400,000 removals per year, because that has certainly been the way the administration has pursued their removals. But at the same time, internally, we know that many are trying to push for qualitative removals as opposed to quantitative removals. And I was wondering if you could speak to that a little more.
You want me to answer? It's definitely a debate, and it's definitely a discussion, both externally and I think within the executive branch. An executive branch, any agency that gets money from Congress has a certain degree of flexibility in how that spending takes place. But that is very, I mean, you know, as an agency, when the Congress is trying to give you money generally for carrying out a mission and when it is very specifically targeted. And it's really, you're at your peril when, with appropriators, having the discussions that go on between appropriators and administrators, an administrator acts differently from what it is that the Congress intends. Now, it is certainly true that the DHS has interpreted the funding for detention and deportation as quantitative, but that's also because it's been very clear that that's what the appropriators are asking for. So I don't think that, I mean, I think that the executive branch has some, and ICE in particular here, has some leeway, which you see in the numbers. I mean, last year the deportation numbers fell to, I think, about 382,000, something like that. Now this year they're back up to some 430,000. So there certainly is that degree of fluctuation, which has not caused a huge problem for the executive branch. But at the same time, Congress expects that money to be used for detention and deportation, and administrators within ICE and DHS probably have a little bit of moving room with that, but they would not, in a wholesale fashion, ignore what it is that's in that appropriations language, I think. So the funding is a very important driver. Very important driver.
Do we want to let anybody make final comments?
I was going to get to that. I want to see if there's, are there any other final questions from the audience? Okay. Any final comments anybody would like to make?
No, thank you again.
Rebecca, how about you, Mark?
No, I mean, I wasn't cueing you because I had something to say. Yeah, I've had enough airtime.
We do somewhat apologize for the density of this information, but not truly, because this is really very important research, and the numbers tell us a great deal. And so we're thankful for your attention. I do want to make an announcement about a future event, which is next Tuesday. We have the annual Immigration Law and Policy Conference, which MPI does in collaboration with the Center for Migration Studies in New York and Clinic, as well as Georgetown Law Center. It's on Tuesday at Georgetown Law Center. We have a very, very substantive lineup of panels for this year. Very, very good speakers, very topical subjects. So the flyer is on your chairs. Registration closes on Friday, so we hope to see you all there next week. And with that, let me close this and invite people to come forward for any further conversation.
For more information, visit the Migration Policy Institute at www.migrationpolicy.org.